Good morning, members. We'll see how the chair does this morning. I'm still scraping away cobwebs. I'm moving a little slow this morning. Members, we've got several bills up this morning. We've got some leftover work from from yesterday. So we'll be acting on those first two bills. And, excuse me, and then we're going to have a conversation about the four QCOP-related, teacher-related bills. My original intent was that we would have, thorough, rough and tough conversation about those and then make and move those bills. However, there are different approaches that are being proposed with those bills, and I think I don't think there's like a right or wrong way to approach it. I think it's just different ways to approach it. And so what I really want us to do is to explore those bills and then do what often we don't give ourselves the time to do, which is this really good reflection about the pros and cons of those approaches. And I know that reflection is often thought of as not action, but frankly, reflection is probably the most important action because without it, we're reacting. And so the time constraints are what they are, but I think it's important that we spend some time this morning without the pressure of having to move a bill as significant as Representative Erickson, your bill's not in the packet?
No. Well, it's in this bag. It's just not on the motions.
Oh, okay.
Sounds like it's going to be a really good day. It's going to be.
Cobwebs are being scraped off as we go. So anyway, with that, members, we're going to start with Representative Morgan, the chair. We'll lift that House File 2396 off the table, and the motion before us is to re-refer House File 2396 to the Committee on Health and Human Services. And Representative Morgan, just to fill us in, just quickly update us on where we're at. Where did we leave this bill a few hours ago, and where are we now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2396, it was the bill to expedite licensing for military service members and their spouses. When we last left, a couple things I want to remind you of. First of all, this bill is not doing the work to expedite the licenses and so forth. It is directing the boards, the professional boards in the state that handle these licensing processes. It is directing them to streamline the process. So each of them is going to be directed to do the work of making this happen. One reminder. Second of all, this does cover more than the Board of Teaching. Obviously, it's here because it certainly does cover the Board of Teaching. Ms. Larson yesterday read a whole list of the different state agencies and different licensing boards that this does apply to. So while we are certainly concerned with the Board of Teaching, there are at least six other committees that are looking at this in terms of the boards that their particular committee has jurisdiction over, and two other authors carrying this bill through those six other committees. So this is a really collaborative work and collegial work that is going on here. Yesterday, what I heard from the group was there was concern about there's a little bit of vagueness in the bill as it was written. And I think that was partly necessary because of the broadness of its application. But I sat down with staff after our meeting yesterday, and we tried to address some of the concerns. And I guess I have an A1 amendment. Before I move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair, I guess I would like staff maybe to share the A1 amendment with the members, and then we can move it and then have a discussion about it and see if that does fulfill the concerns that people have expressed yesterday.
And before we do that, I do want to point out that the A1 amendment technically doesn't meet the committee's own rules. However, technically does, because there's discretionary in that rule. And I just want to state for the public that I would not do this unless we had some good, because it's a substantive enough, you know, amendment, in my opinion. I wouldn't do it unless we had some good agreement and collegiality across the aisle to work on to correct this bill and move it forward the way that we think it should best be moved forward. So I stand to be corrected, if you know, by anyone, if that's the case. Otherwise, we can always come back and meet the deadline next week and do it. But I think there's been a good working relationship with a number of people around the table to do this. So anyway, you're asking for legal counsel to describe the A1?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, members, this concerns the amendment H2396A1 to Representative Morgan's bill proposing to establish an expedited licensing process for members of the military. The beginning of the bill talks about a procedure to expedite, and the last portion of the bill talks about a full application procedure required by applicable law. And it seemed to be that there was some possible confusion about what is expedited under a full procedure and applicable law. And so essentially what this amendment tries to do is to point out what it is that about the licensing process that is unique to the people in this circumstance. So the amendment that creates a new paragraph C, consistent with earlier language in the bill directing affected agencies and boards to adopt a procedure for temporary licensure, it directs each affected agency and board to issue a qualified individual a temporary license or certification. This allows that individual to perform professional services that are regulated by the agency or board. And then here's the distinction for purposes of this bill. An individual remains eligible to perform professional services under a temporary license or certification as long as the individual makes continuous progress in working to meet applicable state licensing or certification requirements. So the point here is that any individual who qualifies for this temporary license or certification retains it so long as that individual makes continuous progress in working to meet the applicable standards in Minnesota. And once that individual meets those applicable standards, then the agency or board must issue that individual a standard license or certification. So all of the state requirements remain in effect, but the individual is able to work under that temporary license as long as progress toward licensure or certification is made.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. And so why don't we put the amendment formally before us? And Representative Erickson, I just want to make sure I'm understanding that you're okay with us moving forward with this amendment at this time. Thank you. So Representative Morgan moves the A1 amendment, and Representative Erdahl has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Morgan. The term continuous progress, very little subjective, and just wondering, for future reference in the record here, what you envision as continuous progress.
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, that's a very good question. The intent of the bill is to direct each licensing board to establish the procedures and guidelines and timelines for this purpose. I would imagine that different boards have different needs or goals, and different professions have different processes already in place. It is my intent to direct the boards to establish guidelines relating to that. I don't think it's because this bill is so broadly based, I don't think it's the intent of anyone who's carrying the bill to get too proscriptive to the individual licensing boards. I think it is our goal to provide them with some guidelines some goals, some legislative goals, but expect them to work within those goals to establish a process that works for that licensing board.
Representative Riddle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Morgan. That's fine. What I was trying to do was to get this on the record so that the future boards and commissions can know what your intent was.
Absolutely.
A wise question. Very well. Any other questions? I'm sorry, Representative Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morgan, I really like what you're trying to do here, but I still find this language and the sections of the bill, the subdivisions, to be almost in conflict. It just bothers me the way that this has been constructed. We want former and current members of the military and their spouses to be able to apply for these licenses and to get jobs. But in your amendment, there's really no discretion. So, you know, I just encourage you to work on this as you move it along. And if we could in some way tighten up, and you've already mentioned this, it's very broad, but tighten this up. I mean, what we've opened up is just normal reciprocity. And I know we'd probably love it in the teaching arena for that out-of-state person who'd like to be licensed, but it does need some work. So thank you for, you know, the intent. I just hope that you will continue to work on tightening the language and making the process, in light of what the governor has just announced in his executive order, that we need plain language, language that everybody can understand, that you would work this out so that there is no question, and pay attention to what Representative Erdahl also mentioned. Thank you.
Representative Urso. I'm sorry, Representative Martin, you wish to.
I appreciate, Mr. Chair, I appreciate Representative Erickson's comments. This amendment does go a little farther than the bill started with. So I see where you're coming up with the conflict there. I was trying with staff to reflect what I was hearing from the committee yesterday. And again, if I were the only author of this bill, moving it through the House, it might be different even still. But I'm trying to work with two other authors. And in the end, it's Representative Mary Murphy who's going to carry this across the finish line. So I will certainly take your words to heart. So thank you.
So, Morgan, you don't get to do the end zone dance?
It'll be a team dance.
Hopefully our military members and their spouses will be doing the end zone dance.
Well done. Representative Morgan, just a quick question. Does this language in any way set up like a perpetual temporary licensing process? I mean, maybe that goes a little bit to the continuous progress question that Representative Erdahl raised.
Mr. Chair, it is not my intent to allow people continuously, forever, perpetually to be given licenses. This language was designed to say you have to be making progress towards that permanent license if you are going to continue on the temporary license. So I want to make that very clear. This is not opening the door to just come on in and we'll let you go forever at some level that may not be to our standards. You have to be making progress towards earning that permanent license you are going to continue to work under this law.
And it's good to have it on record because, as you have said before, you know, the whole bill really sets up a process for these boards so they could be guided by our language and our intent as they do that. Representative Urso has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of echoing Representative Erickson on this. I think the issues we had previously were more about the conflict between what it means to expedite versus the issuing temporary licenses. And the amendment really does establish kind of temporary reciprocity, because it kind of no longer speaks to the qualified individual aspect. It says if you got a license from somebody else, we have to take that at least for a time. And there are plenty of licensures where there's degree requirements that at least historically have varied from state to state, and some of them that are education-related and some of them are not. Nursing comes to mind in terms of reciprocity arguments. So I'm not really very happy about this amendment, and I think it's too... It doesn't give the discretion about who's qualified to do it to the boards that would oversee it, and I realize they could work out what continuous progress means, but if continuous progress means you don't have the requisite bachelor's degree or master's degree or PhD or something yet, that progress could take years if you're working while you're doing it. And so I think it goes well beyond the scope of what we were talking about before. So I'm really not in favor of the amendment.
I'm wondering if perhaps I can call on legal counsel here on this question. I do read the qualified individual language of 1.4, and I think the kind of the tension with this bill is that it is, and the author has consistently said that it's not the intent for the author to write all the conditions under which licenses would be issued. We are continuing to defer to our Board of Teaching to develop a process that's consistent with, you know, the standards that we have set out. But let me ask legal counsel to weigh in on this, because these questions are important, on this question of whether or not there's a clear enough qualifier, if you will, statement in this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Yaruso, members, if you look on page 2 of the bill, paragraph B on page 2, line 4, it defines a qualified individual for purposes of paragraph A, which directs the affected agencies and boards to establish the procedure for temporary licensure. So only a qualified individual, according to the language here, has to meet certain requirements. It's a current valid license, certificate, or permit in another state without history of disciplinary action and a current criminal background study. So it's not, it would be an individual who met these criteria who would be eligible under paragraph C.
Mr. Chair, I would also add that, again, we are not trying to usurp the authority of the licensing boards. We are directing them to do the work to determine for each particular professional license what the standards would be. We are trying to provide guidelines, and really the big picture is we are trying to help the military, active duty service members, their spouses, and people who have recently left active duty the opportunity to apply their professional skills in their new state, where they have been moved in many cases through no choice of their own in their service to our country.
And Representative Morgan, I believe the work that you've done, worked on with Representative Krusha, is a strong movement toward a clear statement of that relative to the bill. And so we have concern with any vagueness. I think this committee's wisdom up to now has been that the bill as drafted is too vague for us. This makes it much more clear. It sounds like there may be some room for us to be even more clear, but we also have a journey in which this bill can travel, and with the strong concerns of this committee and other committees advising it as it does so. Representative Leidinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine is really a comment. I've heard this bill three times. I've heard this in State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs. And I've heard it in Jobs and Economic Development. Now, in both those committees, it was passed unanimously and unchanged. Remember, Section 214.01 covers something like 14 different licensing boards. And, of course, that's why it was cloned to get this thing through all the different committees. The way it is written, the bill is written, I'm going to say, is I think it's very good. It covers everything that needs to be covered. The idea is if a person has been working in this field in another state. And by the way, it's really more targeted for the spouses, I think, more than anything. And certainly the members themselves, the military members themselves, could fall under this as well. But if they've been working in another state, and you know, you're envisioning that Minnesota may just have one or two items that our license says you have to do, it immediately allows for that temporary licensing. And then that person works towards accomplishing what they need to, and then they get the full license, which is why you have it's written the way it is. Very, very well done. So I'm going to make a recommendation. I'm going to recommend we not do this amendment. I don't think it's needed. It hasn't been needed in the other committees. It pretty much lays out everything in the temporary licensing in the current bill, but I'm going to and I'm thinking of this from the military perspective. I'm a former military, and I think that we don't use this and we pass this bill as is. That's my recommendation.
Very well. Any other questions? Very well. Then let's vote on the A1 amendment. All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Motion does not prevail. Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, I agree with Representative Leidiger.
All right, members. Anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill that we held over from yesterday so that we could amend it today that we didn't amend? If not, Representative Morgan renews his motion that House File 2396 be referred as amended to the Committee on Health and Human Service Policy. I'm sorry. You're right. House File 2396 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Morgan,
you,
for
Thank
helping
you,
me get the
Thank
conference.
You, Representative Leidiger.
All right. So we're going to go with that. Okay, very well. Members, we had thought we would do Representative Detmer's bill today, but we'll be doing that on Monday. So in case there were any questions that members had about that. And we've been working with Representative Detmer to make sure that we get the timely hearing on that bill. Representative Bly, House File 2683. And Representative Bly moves that House File 2683 be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Chair Mariani.
It is the intent of the chair to lay this bill over after we have a good description and conversation about the bill. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. This bill was brought to me by Education Evolving, specifically Kurt Johnson, and I really appreciate the work that Education Evolving is doing and advises us. They have a great collection of past education and government officials in their ranks, and among them Bob Wadle, former commissioner, is here to speak to the bill. One of the things I like about their work is they with their experience guide us in ways that I think help us find policies and that actually try to implement best practices and move us forward in a direction that I believe we should go in. And I think this particular bill goes along with some of the direction that we're already trying to move in. I'm going to turn it over in just a minute to Bob Wadle to explain the details of the bill, but I'm very happy to present for you this bill that has to do with response to intervention. And without further ado, I think I'll let Bob speak. I want to say one thing. We did have a couple of handouts, and hoping that we can get those distributed to you.
Very well. Good morning, Mr. Waito. You and I served together in state government when you were Commissioner of the Department of Education. It's good to always good to see you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Waito, and it's always good to be with you. Today, I am representing Education Evolving, which Representative Bly gave you a little bit of background. Today, testifying with me is Dr. Kim Gibbons, who is the Executive Director of the St. Croix River Education District, and also Dr. Matt Burns, who is the Co-Director of the Reading Center at the University of Minnesota and the College of Education. Unfortunately, Dr. Dave Heisted, whom you all know because of his strong research and evaluation background, was able to be with us yesterday, but is not able to be with us today. And Dr. Julia Espy, the superintendent of Princeton, is also not able to be with us, but asked me to convey her support for this bill. I'll walk quickly through the bill and let the experts do added testimony. But basically, to start with this notion of this bill really started in Minnesota in the late 80s and 1990s, called Response to Intervention, as a way to bring the regular classroom and special education really together to really look at the individual needs of students and come up with as many interventions in the regular classroom so that kids wouldn't be referred for special education unless, of course, they really needed it. So it really also came up as an alternative to IQ testing. As Minnesota becomes more and more diverse and looks like the rest of the world, IQ tests simply don't work. I'm not sure if they ever really did work very well, but they certainly don't work when kids from all over the world are coming here to Minnesota. So this bill really builds a systematic method for looking at kids with the core needs of reading and math. This is about the most basic function of education. It's not a huge add-on. It's reading and math. And so we'll get to that a little bit more. But in section one, it lays out eight purposes. And you know, these are really things that the governor and the commissioner and you and our school districts are really focusing on right now. How do we really close that achievement gap? And Dr. Gibbons will show you hard data as to how that can really work. So these purposes are not pie-in-the-sky types of things. We'll show you real data that kids, all of kids will progress. Fewer kids will need special education, et cetera, with this model. Sometimes we say that, you know, that teachers really hate testing. They don't. They hate testing that's of no value to them. And, for example, the MCAs, although valuable for accountability, provide teachers no data that they can use in their classrooms to improve. So part of this bill identifies how can we use the millions and millions of dollars that are being spent on testing to really help teachers improve instruction. Dr. Gibbons will show how it cuts the special education learning disabilities category in half. Now, how does it do that? Because it raises the performance of all kids. The last purpose, Mr. Chair and members, deals with the state testing piece. And you did wonderful work last year in revising our testing model. And this bill suggests a few tweaks as to how that could be made even better. Subdivision 4, this does require a change in rulemaking. So Subdivision 4 lays out for the commissioner how to adjust the current rule to really expand it so that it includes all of these provisions and also removes from the rule one of the things that Dr. Burns will testify on, a provision right now that is really not good for children. And so it's called a severe discrepancy model based on IQ testing, and Dr. Burns will be testifying on that. Subdivision 5 identifies how can assistance be provided to our 1,500 sites or whatever number of sites that we now have in Minnesota. It lays out a number of options. Just to remind you, back in 2007, I think, the legislature did name the St. Croix River Education District as Minnesota's RTI center, and it did have an appropriation. Then in 2009, when you also did have budgets with large numbers, but they had parentheses around them, and you had to reduce budgets, that was one of the unfortunate budgets that was eliminated. So basically what we're saying that in the bill that the commissioner could use federal money to finance the assistance to sites. And that's what other states are doing. Minnesota is kind of now a laggard with other states that are moving in this direction. Wisconsin, the most recent state, is using federal Title I and special ed money to provide this assistance. I know my very good friends in districts are going to say, but we need an appropriation, and you know, who would be opposed to that? But again, this is the most basic stuff in schools, reading and math. And one of the things that Education Evolving tries to emphasize is we cannot just continue to pile one thing on top of the other and one appropriation on top of the other. This bill speaks to doing things differently. For example, Dr. Gibbons will testify how the role of the school psychologist changes from giving IQ tests, spending almost all of their time in testing, to spending almost all of their time in assisting with designing interventions. The school psychologist in most of our schools is the most expensive person, other than the principal. So we're devoting the most expensive person to doing things that are of limited value. So under this bill, they would now be able to spend their time working with kids, helping teachers design interventions. We also know, I think this committee knows, the value of the Minnesota Reading Corps. I was the first education director of the Reading Corps, and we designed that around the response to intervention model. Now you've got 1,700 to 2,000 people out there highly trained in reading interventions and math interventions, and that fits right into this model. So that's another way to use resources differently. Also, in the 2009 legislation, you passed a way to use special education differently. Not many districts are doing that, but that is a way to use resources differently. So my response to people that say, well, we need more money, I would suggest we need to redesign and restructure how we're using our current resources. Then the last provision of the bill dealing with statewide testing, the bill calls for the commissioner to form a committee. That was never the intent. The commissioner has a testing committee, so no additional committee really is needed. But it's asking questions. How do we, now that Pearson has the new contract, how do we make sure that those data, that testing, serves multiple purposes? Minnesota, really, up until now, we do not have a state test. We have two state tests. 80% of Minnesota kids are tested on the MAP and, of course, 100% on the MCAs. We have two state tests. Let's not do that. That costs tens of millions of dollars to do that. Let's make sure that our state test provides data that are useful to teachers for instructional decision making so that the districts don't have to go out and buy added tests so that their teachers have information that's useful to them. So that's what this section is really talking about. How do we use then the state test so that it can be given multiple times or at least pieces of it can? How do we link it with the other international tests? We often say, let's not compare ourselves to South Dakota and South Carolina. We need to compare ourselves with South Korea. Well, how do we take current data and equate it to national tests, right? I mean, and international tests. So that those are some of the things that, that the commissioner's committee would be asked to do. And also it links directly into the world's best workforce. If the MAP test does have predictive validity about what kind of careers kids can go into based on their performance. Let's try to make sure that the new state test does this as well. So, Mr. Chair and members, that's a quick overview. I'd like to refer to Dr. Gibbons to lay out a little bit more detail as to how these purposes of the bill really get carried out.
Thank you. Mr. Waddell, and let me just add, it's my understanding that under current law, the statutes do speak of a requirement to have an assessment of some form. So this is relative to the RTI part of this bill. And so I mention that only to share that while the emphasis on an MTSS instrument here is, you know, a big push of the bill. The legislature over time in our statutes reflect the need to have an assessment that could lead toward the use of RTI-like methodologies and approaches with students. So, you know, if folks are thinking we're carving out a brand new thing here, we're really not. I think in the proposal you're trying to build off of, you know, existing base and statute, where we have expressed an interest in making sure that we have appropriate assessments relative to these students and to the goals that you're hoping to accomplish through an RTI or another similar instrument. And I'll stand to be corrected by future folks if that's not the case. But Ms. Gibbons, you're up. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Kim Gibbons. I'm the Executive Director of the St. Croix River Education District. I'm also the current president of the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education.
Welcome, Dr. Gibbons.
Thank you. The St. Croix River Education District, or SCRED, has been implementing an RTI framework since 1995. I think it's fair to say that we were early implementers of this approach. As Mr. Waddell said, response to intervention or multi-tiered systems of support, MTSS seems to be the new federal buzzword, is a multi-tiered approach to the early identification and support of students with learning and behavioral needs. The model starts with providing quality core instruction to all kids in the regular ed classroom, and we do periodic screenings of students 3 times a year. We figure out which students are at risk for not meeting our grade level standards, and we provide those students with interventions, and we monitor their progress to make sure that those interventions are working. Educational decisions about the intensity of interventions are made based on an individual student response to the instruction and interventions that we're providing. So RTI is really designed as a system-wide reform of regular education, and then data that results from that process can also be used to help make special education entitlement decisions. Over the past 19 years that we've implemented this framework, we've seen significant increases in achievement for all students. I'm proud to say that in my group of 6 districts, as of last year, we had 4 districts that had schools that were either reward schools or celebration schools under the new categorical system of ratings of schools. And I wanted to just share a little bit of data. We've got lots of data at SCRED, and I just picked out a couple pertinent ones to share with you today. The first slide that you see is looking at the screening measures that we use in reading. We use a 1-minute time.
Dr. Gibbons, I apologize, but okay. I just want to point out to members, we do have copies of the slides in
your
packets. Sometimes it's hard for us to read what's up on the screen,
okay.
But there are copies of slides in the packets. So please continue. My apologies
Thank you.
For interrupting.
We use a number of screening measures, but one of the screening measures that we use is a one-minute sample of reading. We have students read out loud for 1 minute, and we count the number of words they read correctly in 1 minute. Strange as that may sound, that one-minute sample of reading correlates very highly to the overall domain of broad reading, and it correlates very highly and significantly to our statewide assessments. So rather than wait until third grade when the students begin to take the statewide assessments, we can know right away in kindergarten which students are on track to be proficient when they take the third grade MCA. So the graph that you see, it's a little bit hard to read, and I don't know if you have the colored copies, but I think the big idea that I wanted you to see is that when we started doing these screenings in 1996, our average proficiency across SCRED was between 20 and 30% of kids proficient at target. And that was not a good moment for us. And we spent a lot of time at that point working on our core reading instruction because we did not have the resources to provide extra supplemental instruction to 70% of our school population. So we've really focused hard on improving the core reading instruction that all kids get. And over time, you can see that our last screening measure from last spring, you know, we have many of the grade levels close to 80% proficient, some a little bit lower, but we've made significant progress over the course of implementing this framework. We've also seen significant acceleration of growth rates for our most at-risk learners, and I didn't bring that slide to share, but I have data that shows at every grade level that we've seen double to triple an increase in student growth rate over a 15-year time period for the students that struggle the most. The graph that I'm showing you right now is our child count, and it's the number of kids that the St. Croix River Ed District has categorized as needing specific learning disability or SLD services. And the SCRED is the blue triangle, and you can see that in 1994-95, we were above the state average and the regional average in the number of kids that we identified, the percentage of kids. And you can see over the time period that we've implemented this approach that we've seen a dramatic decrease in the number of kids that we've identified. And I think if you put that together with the first graph that I showed that showed huge increases in achievement for all kids, I think it really speaks to the preventative nature of this model. Identifying fewer special education students has also reduced paperwork for special education teachers. We have fewer kids identified, and now teachers can actually spend their time providing instruction to students, which is something that obviously we know has the greatest impact on student achievement. Since 2005, we have used data from the RTI process to make special ed entitlement decisions. Right now in Minnesota, there are two ways that districts can identify students as specific learning disabled. The first way is to give a student an intelligence test and then give an achievement test, and then you look to see if there's a large enough discrepancy or difference between those two scores. That model has problems with reliability, with validity, and the most practical problem is it's a wait-to-fail approach, and we oftentimes cannot identify students for services until the gap has gotten so big, and at that time, usually it's third, fourth, or fifth grade, and it becomes very difficult to remediate problems at that point.
And Dr. Gibbons, the common lingo for that is the severe discrepancy
test.
Yes,
the severe discrepancy concept or model. I was in my doctoral program in the early 1990s reading research from the 1980s showing that this approach was flawed. Wow. And I just really think it's time that policy in Minnesota catches up with science and that we really have a model in place that is really going to improve outcomes for kids. So the second option that's currently available in law is that instead of using the severe discrepancy approach, districts can use data, progress monitoring data from the RTI process, and use that data to help determine and make a decision on which kids require special education assistance. We've done that since 2005. We have not seen the floodgates open in special education. I really believe that we're targeting assistance to the kids in each grade level that have the most severe instructional needs and need the most intensity in their programming. And then finally, I'll just end by saying that Mr. Wadle did reference that SCRED was hosting an RTI center in 2007 to 2009. And I really feel that there's been a noticeable void of technical assistance and support for the state. We still get calls to our office 2 to 3 times a week, and this is how many years later, of people saying, can you come out and help us? And I have to say, I'm sorry, right now, you know, we're providing support to our 6 districts, but I really hope that we can come up with a model that will move Minnesota to an implementation statewide of RTI, MTSS, and then provide the technical assistance that's needed to help make that successful.
So, Dr. Gibbons, the investment that we made a few years ago allowed that particular district, which had, you know, at that point was pioneering the RTI assessment approach, allowed that to be a statewide resource. So it made it possible for you to be able to spend time with other districts to develop their.
That's correct.
Okay. Very well. Representative Bly.
Dr. Burns for our final testimony.
Thank you. Dr. Burns, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I can be brief. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to talk with you today about how we diagnose children with learning disabilities in Minnesota. My name is Matthew Burns. I'm a professor of educational psychology, co-director of the Minnesota Center for Reading Research, and coordinator of the school psychology program at the University of Minnesota. Topic of conversation today is how we diagnose children with learning disabilities. Yeah. Currently, a child is diagnosed with a learning disability, LD, if they, A, do not achieve adequately in one or more of the following areas, and they list several areas, including reading, basic reading skills, reading comprehension, reading fluency, math calculation, math problem solving, B, has a disorder in one or more of the basic psychological processes, and C, demonstrates a severe discrepancy between general intellectual ability and achievement in one or more of the areas listed, or D, demonstrates an inadequate rate of progress over time in response to evidence-based interventions. The federal law allows for state educational agencies to not allow the use of what we're calling the severe discrepancy, that Part C, which is a move that I think would be great for the children of Minnesota, because in my opinion, the discrepancy model could be the most discredited educational practice still in effect today. And I would argue, honestly, I think we have one of the worst diagnostic LD diagnostic models in the country. The idea of a discrepancy model came about in 1975 when federal law first was passed in which LD was defined, and there was no common way to diagnose a child as LD at the time. The way we used to do it was called the Illinois Test of Psycholinguistic Ability. It came out in 1968. Research in those 7 years showed that it was not a good measure. It didn't work well at all. And so in 1975, they literally did not have any other option, so the discrepancy came out of a compromise because it kind of made sense. Because if a child is this smart and they're reading here and there's no explanation for that, then that would be a learning disability. While it may have made sense, it just didn't work. Using a discrepancy between IQ and achievement results in unreliable decisions. If test has a reliability of 0.85, without being too technical, if a test has a reliability of 0.85, which is quite high, that means 15% of the score is due to error. If you compare two tests, you're compounding that. And so if you have two tests with a reliability of 0.85, which again is high, 28% of that decision is due to error. And so we're making decisions based on error a frequent amount. As Dr. Gibbons mentioned, the discrepancy model is a wait-to-fail approach. It's really difficult for a child to score low enough on an achievement test for there to be a discrepancy until at least third or fourth grade. Scores of zero on most achievement tests turn into standard scores that are close to the average range. And so it's really difficult for a child to score low enough until they're older, at which time it's not too late, but it's much more difficult to remediate. Research has consistently shown that discrepancy model does nothing to improve instruction. And research by Jim Isodike here at the University of Minnesota and others have found that discrepancy model decisions were heavily influenced by cultural and racial biases. The RTI model that was currently allowed, for which we're arguing should be the sole way to identify learning disabilities, has much more positive outcomes associated with it, allows for early identification intervention, increases student learning, but you know, Dr. Gibbons has already talked about that. In conclusion, there's no reason to continue the discrepancy approach to LD diagnosis. I'd be happy to provide any references for anything I've said today or expand on any of the points. Thank you again for the opportunity to summarize some of the research.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Burns. I'm just wondering, really quickly, Mr. Waddell, so I just want to get an understanding of the lay of the land. So right now, we have a practice, if you will, for many years, ingrained deeply in our education delivery and assessment of students' approaches, heavily centered on the use of the severe discrepancy test in terms of attempting to identify students who may have behavioral or learning needs that we can then supplement and intervene with special ed. So I guess my question is there something compelling in state statute for districts to use that assessment? Is that part of what we're perhaps trying to address here, is that there is a statutory directive to use the SDT? And then my other question is, and this is a broader question, if this bill moves, I suspect the finance, excuse me, this question would arise. So what's the capacity or the resource needs of districts to be able to move quickly if there is a direct statement in statute to either stop using such an assessment or thou shalt now use this assessment? So a couple of questions.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Those are very good questions. I'll let Dr. Gibbons, who's the president of the state organization, speak to why do other districts do what they do. First of all, the bill before you does remove that severe discrepancy option for the reasons that Dr. Burns testified. It is not good for children, and it ought not be the state policy to permit that as an option. But we do provide for a three-year phase-in.
I know I'm interrupting here, but what I'm getting at, so thank you for that, but what I'm getting at, so where does that lie? Where is that? Is that in rule? Is that in statute?
Mr. Chair, it is in the commissioner's rule.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Yeah.
And then you were, I crudely interrupted, I apologize, and then you said the bill then does a three-year...
There's a three-year phase-in... To enable districts to be able to move to this model.
Okay.
But I'd like to have Dr. Gibbons comment as to the status of districts around the state using RTI and those using severe discrepancy. I know she doesn't have the exact data, but has a pretty good hunch. Okay.
Dr. Gibbons.
Thank you. The department commissioned the Wilder Foundation to do develop a survey last year to survey the state, all of the schools, to find out where they were at with RTI MTSS implementation. And the results of that survey are available. I'm just going off of guesstimate, but there was about 1,000 school districts that responded to the survey. And I think the estimates are that somewhere between 50% and 60% of districts are probably implementing aspects of the RTI framework. I think the survey really highlighted the need for professional development. There were many areas that districts were rating themselves really at the beginning stages of implementation. As to why more districts aren't using this approach, I think the push is that, there's really currently not an incentive to move away from the old model. And the old model is pretty easy. It's pretty easy to just give a student an IQ test and give an achievement test and look up on a chart to see if a student qualifies. And the new model requires skills and training and professional development. And as Dr. Burns said, I'm a school psychologist by training as well, and we need our psychologists and our teachers collecting data that will help inform their instruction and drive their instruction, and that's what data from this process will do. So the the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education have this on their platform that we really want to increase the use of evidence-based practices around the state, and this is one area that we remain concerned about.
But if I could also add, Mr. Chair, that this is what districts are all doing now. I mean, I'm not full-blown RTI, but looking at data, I don't know that there's any district and site, especially at the elementary level of the state, that isn't using some types of the one-minute reading samples that Dr. Gibbons identified. So, you know, I think everybody's pretty much using parts of this. What this bill does and the commissioner's rule would be really to have add more systematic application to it, provide the assistance, and then the piece dealing with the larger testing, the state testing, how to make that information also a useful component of the whole process.
Very well. Thank you. We do have a couple questions from members. Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, thank you very much for being here today. And we did hear last year, I think, in K-12 finance, Dr. Kim, Dr. Kim Gibbons, we heard you. And you did a very impressive presentation at that point when we were looking at potential areas for funding. I was on the Mankato School Board for about 12 years, and Mankato does use RTI, but they don't use it exclusively throughout their district. And so I have a number of questions that relate to how you build a coalition for districts to move to a full RTI model. I'm more reluctant to do the kind of legislation you're calling for here that overlays from the top unless we, there really is ownership at the district level for the process. And so we use RTI, I believe, in special education, but we have other methods for screening our kindergartners. We use DIBLS. And if Dr. Heisted were here, I think he'd testify that there's at least a half a dozen early elementary instruments that have a high rate of reliability and validity that are used throughout our districts. So I'm wondering what kind of work you may have done or might prospectively consider doing to bring all the professionals that would be implicated by this type of a mandate from the state together to own the capacity and potential for that mandate before we would move as a state.
Dr. Goodman.
Well, thank you. Your question is actually really timely because on Wednesday of this week, I pulled together key representatives from the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, MASA, MACE, the Elementary Principals Association, the Secondary Principals Association, and the Curriculum Directors. And the purpose of the meeting was to talk about how, as a group of five organizations, we could really band together and collaborate around instruction and improving instruction. And at the end of the day, we generated a list of topics and ideas that we could all collaborate on them. RTI MTSS was on the top three of the list of ways that we could collaborate. So really excited about that. You ask a great question, though, about capacity, and I think that's really why we want this to have a sunset provision for the current SLD law and have a three-year phase-in period. I actually have been doing some consultation with Mankato in the last couple of years, and I'm really using the model that the former RTI Center used, that we start with kind of a 3 to 4 year plan for, first of all, getting everybody on board within the district, building consensus, and then really working our way through what are all the assessments that we use? How do we get data teams and teachers together looking at data? What are the interventions that we use? So it's not something that happens overnight. It takes time and coaching.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate that response, and that's exactly part of my point. But I would say Mankato has been on this road, not specifically with RTI, but the broader road of data-driven decisions, evidence-based learning teaching practices for 20 years. And we've had very focused efforts on training our staff and using whatever assessment data is available to them on a on-the-ground way. And this relates more to some of Dr. Weidel. I don't know if I'm pronouncing your name right, sir. Weidel. Sorry. Okay. To your concern about how we better align our testing system, and I would say I've had interest in that issue for about 25 years. I started as a parent on our local assessment committee in Mankato and kind of worked my way up to here, and that's still been an ongoing issue and concern for me. And I think it's a very complex issue, and there's not an easy answer to it. You know, the issue, and again, if Dr. Heisted were here, I think he'd testify to some of this, the capacity for statewide assessment, a summative assessment to have formative aspects is highly debated across the discipline and has limited applicability. Now, to say that the same company delivering that summative assessment might have tools that could be used in formative ways is a different matter, and we've tried to build some of that into our requirements in the assessment reform we put in place last session around especially our 3-7 computer adaptive, on grade, off grade. So there's a lot of flexibility, very similar to the information you might get from the NWEA and the MAP testing. One of the things we can't constrain is who responds to our RFPs, and NWEA did not respond to our statewide RFP there for whatever series of reasons. And the whole relationship between the vendor and the state's vision is a complex one legally. To have the vendor at the table while we're modeling the next set of assessments has certain legal limitations, as I understand it. Your recommendations around assessment, I really appreciate, and I think we're working toward them, and we'd be happy to have you in the conversation with us. But the commissioner actually did shape an accountability and assessment work group a few years ago, and they discussed several of the things on your recommendations and had some response to them. It's an ongoing discussion, and I'm appreciative of the work you're doing, Dr. Gibbons, with bringing organizations together, because for me, there really has to be broad ownership before I would be and feel we could move as a state, not to affect the rulemaking issue you're talking about. That seems to me to be more targeted and doable, but to mandate RTI.
Chair Mariani, if I could just respond. We've spoken about this a little bit beforehand, and I have talked with education involving folks, and we are willing to work with you to come up with something that's workable. And we're happy that the bill will be laid over for possible consideration, so that we can do some amendments and work on those issues. So I think there is a real willingness to work with you and come up with something that will work.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, Dr. Heisted and I work very closely together. He and I worked together in Minneapolis when I was there. So a lot of the things that he has articulated, we discuss regularly. We too are disappointed that NWA did not bid that, because that tool, of course, is both formative and summative. It does have the leveling capacity, which for some reason the federal government doesn't appreciate. But I guess all our point is that yes, we do need good data. So let's make sure our systems are working together so that we can have multiple purposes for the expense of data that we do collect, because it's not just the collection of data, it's the days and days and days of time that the children are not in instruction. So sometimes we say, you want to add a week to the school year? No problem. Let's coordinate our testing so that there's more time for instruction.
And that's perhaps an acute issue this year with so many missed school days with our great northern winters here. Representative Sawatsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm busy on my phone, my iPad, every place, talking to my people back at home. It's no surprise that I am a special education teacher, and my assignment, due to being in the House of Representatives, is we negotiated, so to speak, that our department at the middle school, we had a 0.5 teacher, and that 0.5 teacher was the assessor. And so when I became a representative, I assumed that position, so I test all the initials in the reevaluations of learning disability, only LD kids, learning disabled. And so not the EBD kids. I don't do any of the DCD kids. Those respective teachers do that. So with that said, In the district that I am in, we have been slow to get onto RTI. And special ed did not want to take on this beast because it's not a special ed issue. It is a general ed issue. And they need to get on board. And I don't want to throw anybody under the bus. But we need to have good leaders that are willing to step up to the plate. And we're in, this is 2014. And I agree. We cannot continue to do things as we have done over and over and over and over again. And I think as educators, we sometimes forget, we don't take the time to look at the data because we're so busy doing the work. And, you know, I love the ideas of going to work with the PLCs and having committees to evaluate data and all that. And our school did a lot of that. But guess what? We extended our school day, but now all the teachers are in meetings. And so when I want to go out and talk to the teachers before school, they're in meetings and PLCs to discuss the data. And I'm still not seeing the teachers to talk about what the kid that I'm testing about. And it's just, we're working towards good things, but it's contradictory as well. So with that said, we have a brand new psych that I've been working with, and she's great. So I'm talking to her right now about RTI, and she says, "Oh, Miss Gibbons, it's good. I like what they're doing." And she said, "And she said, yeah, I believe in RTI, and they do it in a different district that they're into it more than my district is, but my district is finally on board." But it's building. What I'm trying to get to is this. She is saying, I don't like to do it the way Wisconsin did it. They did it 1 year, let's go. It takes 10 years to implement, to do it well, and you know more about this than I do. But it's not something that's going to happen overnight, I believe. It's not happening in my district overnight. And I do think that we need to do it responsibly and all that. But I also think we don't have time to waste because, for instance, all the testing that we've done this year, and to get my paperwork done was working days and nights and weekends, so I could put that off my plate. But just to buy the protocols on for the psych tests or my Woodcock-Johnson tests are hundreds of dollars. And nope, you can't copy those because that's copyright. Hundreds of dollars are being put into testing assessments, and then for my students at my level, it takes 4 class periods. No matter how you shake it, I have to take those kids out of their classes at a minimum of 4 class periods, and we have set 47-minute class periods to do the testing, to do the personal interviews, the one-to-ones for transition, because you have to talk to them about their careers and what they want to be and what they do in their community and what they can do at home. And so no way, whether you're high intelligence or borderline, it always takes me 4 class periods out of their class day. But the work after that with all the other teacher input that I get, and it's really good. But you know what? We never do sit down and talk about it. And that's the other issue we have to really talk about here is we need time in the school day to talk about these kids and not just grab 10 minutes here and there on the fly. So I really hope that people are listening, I'm an old dog here because I still look at an IQ and say, okay, I know that they're above average or below average, and so I have a lot of learning too. My learning curve is huge on this because we're not put into this 100%. But I still believe in IQs because that's what I'm comfortable with. But at the same time, I know that if we can test fewer kids and the kids that we really need to aim not have to reach 2 years or below to get that discrepancy, and that is a shame. With that said, thank you. I hope that we can move the ball, but I like to go a little bit faster than some people. And we have to. We have to do this right, and I agree. But I also want to know that we need to get a lot of people on board, and we need to change the thinking of state of Minnesota and the leaders that lead us, because we're doing the work and we can't do it all alone.
Thank you. I think you've captured very eloquently the tension that constantly exists for us as lawmakers in terms of creating a policy frame that has this sense of urgency, that, you know, has a compelling, urgent, you know, push, at the same time moderated by making sure that we're doing things responsibly, which really is a lot of around, you know, very pragmatic issues that you've identified several here. You know, how quickly can we move things around in a responsible way? how do we address capacity issues? You know, shifting out of, you know, one system to another, if you will. I think it's a constant anxiety for all members here. Just how hard do we push in terms of a policy frame? And obviously, you're thinking about that and factoring that in as well with the proposal before you. We have three other members, and then we'll ask take quick testimony from the audience, and then we're going to. Then we're going to move on. We're going to lay this bill over, and we'll continue to work on it. So, Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for coming today. A special welcome and thank you to Dr. Gibbons, whose SCRED district my districts are part of your SCRED district, and so I appreciate all the work you've done over the past few years since I've known you and talked to you about all these issues. You've done a great job. Your credibility is unimpeached, and I appreciate you coming forward. I kind of have a similar mind as Representative Swatsky. She had said she was, you know, iPad, iPhone, and all that to ask her experts in her area. I went straight to the source, which is my wife. And I just asked her, texted her, do you like RTI? She works in the Pine City School District outside of my district but inside of SCRED. And she said, yes, with four exclamation points. She said it helps SPED kids be mainstreamed and prevents other kids being labeled special ed when not. And I think that kind of cuts to the core of the whole thing. So RTI, good evidence-based program. The question, though, I have is we have a bill in front of us that mandates RTI. And I'm thinking of that, and I'm thinking, why aren't they using it on their own? I mean, we have a lot of districts with a lot of problems and who get a lot of money. And I might say, add on to it, that the districts I represent are some of the lower-funded districts in the state who have found the time and money to implement RTI because it's effective. I'm struggling. And I'm asking the wrong people, of course, but what can you tell us about that? Why aren't other districts who have lots of big problems implementing it on their own? Sorry to put you on the spot.
Dr. Gibbons.
Thank you. It's a great question. I think Mr. Wadle said earlier, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any district in Minnesota that isn't implementing some aspect of the RTI framework. RTI is all about database decision-making, collaborative teams, tiers of instruction. Now, to be fair, not every district in Minnesota is doing every aspect of the framework, but I always think RTI really could stand for really terrific instruction. It's really what it's about, is just using good instruction to make decisions about kids. So I think the problem that we have is we have lots of districts implementing aspects of this model, but when we get to the point of making special ed entitlement decisions, there's a huge disconnect. And I think what we want to do is have an integrated system where the decisions that we're making in regular ed then flow into decisions that we're making in special ed. And I think, you know, we've had this alternative has been available for so many years. And like you said, Representative Swatsky, you kind of do what you're comfortable with for a while. And I think until there's a reason to change, it's not going to happen without any type of incentive or mandate. I guess I don't like that word, but a mandate.
Good.
Representative,
quick follow-up question. So we're talking about kids' lives, and the ones that go into special ed that appropriately should have education in that area. But the ones that don't or can be mainstreamed out, your graph is pretty specific, and I don't know if it directly correlates with the implementation of RTI, but talking about kids and lives and, again, funding, in that if kids are mainstreamed, that's the goal. Kids are mainstreamed, less money is devoted to something that's unnecessary, which is pretty important and a pretty big reason why they would want to implement RTI, because it's the best course of action. Are other states mandating RTI? Are there other, especially those in the area, Wisconsin perhaps, or any other state near us?
Mr. Burns.
Yes.
Yes, there are currently 11 states in the country that have said you can no longer use severe discrepancy, you must use RTI. Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa being the ones that are closest to us. Colorado is another one, Florida.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Erickson, Sandra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if anyone at the table can answer this, but perhaps you, Dr. Gibbons. To what extent can districts use the IDA or federal dollars? You were talking about the special ed budget, but to what extent can you pull and use for RTI?
Dr. Gibbons.
There is a provision in federal law that allows districts to use 15% of their federal dollars for what's called early intervening services, which would fit right within that supplemental intensive interventions.
Okay, well, Representative Depp, Representative Faust, I cheated, I added you on, but then we'll start moving toward transitioning to the other bill. Representative Depp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And appreciate the bill coming forward. My school district uses RTI and likes it a lot, and has gotten good results from the use of it. So I appreciate that. I do want to go a little bit. I'm just a little confused on a couple of provisions, and so I want to go to the language of the bill. I see on 2.28 and 2.9, the commissioner shall adopt the RTI model not later than August 30, 2015. With implementation August 1, 2017. But then if I go to 3.22, it's beginning not later than August 1st, 2014, the commissioner shall provide leadership and assistance to districts to implement it. And so it seems like we're saying, first you implement it, then you create the rules, and then you start doing it. And there's carts and horses, and I'm not sure what else in there. But I'm trying to get them in the right order. Can somebody help me, please?
Well, I think I think because of the way it's not necessarily organized, talking about the different sections and the way that will happen in order. So, because we're talking about rulemaking over here and how that has to be implemented over time and phased in, over here we're talking about the assistance, and before it can be fully implemented, you have to provide that assistance.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr.
Cavity, yeah, you're right. Part of the leadership for RTI came out of Minneapolis because of the increase in the kids of color in the early 90s. Obviously, the IQ test was just a disaster, was identifying everybody as special ed. The way it was written that way was because what's laid out in the bill in terms of what needs to be in the rule is pretty self-explanatory, and the model in the research, the RTI model in the research is a pretty common model. So we felt that assistance in getting started with this could be simultaneous with the actual development of the rule.
So as I understand the response, the language on page 3, at least in its initial period of time, is not language that compels. It's language that sets up, as districts want to move forward, let's have the commissioner provide assistance and meanwhile, the rule will evolve, and then we're now talking about a compelling, a mandate, if you will, for all districts. Representative Devin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the clarification there. I think I've got a question for staff, if I may, Ms. Larson. And this is a 35,000-foot concern. I don't want this misunderstood as in any way being negative towards SCRED or Serve Minnesota. I'm a big fan of both. But Ms. Larson, on 3.28 and 2.9, it says specifically, the department shall contract with SCRED. And then on 4.13, it says, you shall work with Serve Minnesota. And that's probably all great. But I'm thinking that normally we would say, you contract with someone highly qualified to do this, rather than name specifically an organization, an agency, an entity. Have I not had enough coffee this morning, or can you respond, please?
Representative Dabney, and before Ms. Larson does respond, I do want to, it's a great question, and I had the same kind of, and I've spoken a little bit with the commissioner about this, and she had the same kind of observation, quite frankly. But the language on 3.25 is permissive language. So it looks like you're identifying, you know, an asset, if you will, in the state. But Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, often our practice is to describe the circumstances or the requirements for a contract. For example, with an RFP, then we direct the commissioner, bearing in mind the criteria, to find the contractor ordinarily.
Thank you. One comment, if I may, on a different concern, and it's a concern I have. I appreciate the move towards summative assessment formative assessment rather than summative. Pardon me. There you see. But I do need to bring up, since most of that now is online, that there's a very real capacity challenge for a lot of schools. I see that this in my children's schools in Minneapolis. I saw this in the schools I taught in Buffalo, where the computer labs get used for testing and not for teaching. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to, you know, if we're going to throw out all those 21st century skills and that sort of thing, then we have to actually let the kids at the computer to do something other than answer A, B, C, or D. And so if we push out yet more formative assessment, there's a lot of benefit there. But there's also potentially some loss or some resource challenge there that I think we should also be mindful of.
Right, and typically at times we've pulled together smart stakeholders to come back with, you know, recommendations about how we would balance those kind of. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we've always hit the spot in terms of it, but that would be one approach. I see noddings of the head, so I'm just going to keep pushing on. Representative Fowles, that's the last question here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that you probably remember in 2007, I suspect that Representative Erickson, I think you came along on the trip as well, and I don't remember if anybody else here did or not, when the Education Finance Committee went up to Hinckley. If I remember right, it was the roads were very icy that night, and we were lucky to make it there. But we went to Hinckley, which is a part of the St. Croix River Education District, and we learned an awful lot about RTI. We saw how they used the software and all of this stuff. We passed that year what we referred to as the RTI bill, and there were two main parts to that, and both Dr. Waddell and Dr. Gibbons, I believe, both helped pass that. And so correct me if I'm wrong, but there were two parts to that. One was setting up the RTI Center, which I think helps address why the St. Croix River Education District is probably mentioned in the bill itself, is because they did this before, and they did that for 2 years, and so I think that is part of the reason why. The other part of the bill was actually changing the state statutes to allow schools to do what the St. Croix River education system was doing, which is allowing special ed teachers in the general ed classrooms to prevent some of the students from needing this special ed. And I think that this is responding to Representative Barrett's question as far as why haven't more schools done this, is the department never sent out a letter telling the schools that had happened so that they could do that. And neither the Dayton administration nor the Plenty administration had ever done that. And so I think that part of the reason that more schools haven't implemented this is that the department has never told them that they could legally do the things that the first bill changed to allow to happen. And so I think that that addresses part of that issue as well. So schools are still doing it, and they find out on their own. but there was never a big push from the department saying, this is a good idea, you can now do this. So, thank you.
Thank you for the for helping us recollect how you know our work in this area several years ago. Typically, that would be the signal to have the department come and defend or explain itself, but quite frankly, we'll come back to this bill and there'll be an opportunity for that to happen. In the meantime, I think you've garnered some really good feedback from the committee here, and I would encourage you, Representative Bly, to work with that, and you know, we'll find a way to squeeze this very big, important bill, hopefully, inside the next couple of weeks that yeah. we have left in our, you know, before we hit our policy deadline. There is one person that wanted to testify quickly about the bill, and then I'm going to move on. But before we do that, I do want to thank Dr. Burris, Dr. Gibbons, Mr. Wado for being here. And why don't we hear from, and then we'll have you just pulls us out.
Okay.
And I do want to move very quickly here, so no more than 4 minutes or so. Thank you all. Mr. Heller, you wish to make a comment? Is there anyone else that wishes to offer quick pearls of wisdom for the committee before we move on? If so, please come forward. Mr. Heller, I only have a few minutes, so I really appreciate it if you can be very concise. It's good to see you.
My name is Rick Heller, unofficially represented twice exceptional and print disabled. Thank you, Chair and members, for the opportunity to come and speak today. One of the reasons I have to say unofficial is because we've never had a meaningful discussion anywhere that I know in the state regarding who are the twice exceptional and print disabled. Come to speak today on House File 2683. First of all, it's my understanding, and people can do their homework, however, I believe the legislature defunded RTI and Stillwater in 2009. And I don't know how we can mandate something that we don't have a full model developed yet. Number two, since the federal government defunded Excel project at St. Thomas in 2011 through the Jarvis money, I don't know how we can honestly move ahead with RTI. Since now we added twice exceptional and gifted statute last year. Under 120B.15, under B, subpart 2. We also added low-income minority and English language learners to that. I know that RTI perhaps needs to take a serious look at what it means to read well. Frankly, I don't know what that means. I do know there's five strands of reading. I think Minnesota might have missed the mark on the motivation to read, which is found on the No Child Left Behind under item F, which is two key words that stand out for me, which is motivation and development of reading. I'm not sure how universe is designed for learning, which was in House File 2 at the last day, but never passed, which how this all might relate to these twice exceptional learners as well, and also found in the Minnesota waiver, which hasn't been accessible to the 2012-2013 year for the legislature and for the blind and print disabled. However, they did make it fully accessible starting in October of 2013. I do like the idea of a sonar meeting, which is about the having a hearing. I think to have a meaningful hearing, just who are the twice exceptional, because the teachers union in 2006, the NAA, wrote a paper called The Twice Exceptional Dilemma. They identify four types of these learners, SLD, EDB, emotional behavior disorder, sorry, said that, ADHD, and the autism spectrum group. So again, without appropriate models, really with no funding that I can see, I had asked one representative some time ago last year that if the twice exceptional label is another unfunded mandate, and if that is true, what I had heard, which was a yes, then I don't know how we can, again, mandate something that we don't really have a full model developed yet, not only in the teachers area, but also in the classroom setting. Last but least, I have petitioned the Board of Teaching last few meetings to consider certification for the twice exceptional, but they don't want to respond to me. However, the legislature has the authority to ask that question. And since the Summer Institute took place at St. Thomas regarding twice exceptional, maybe that's something else you'll have a meaningful discussion in the future. And once again, we all know that special ed and achievement is about appropriate access into the curriculum, which is about universal design for learning. But when you talk about IQ, that's all about potential and ability. And that's the differences between why we don't want to use a discrepancy model anymore. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. I appreciate your testimony and your advocacy on this issue. Representative Bly, close this out, and then we'll lay this bill over.
Okay. Just a quick little story. Back in the 1980s, I was a teacher in a cross-categorical level 5 EBD LD classroom, and I negotiated some time with my district to be able to go out and try to work with folks before they got in the need of my services. And I wasn't really able to meet with students because of the restrictions that were in place then, but I did meet with teachers. I was often frustrated by not only for LD, but EBD students who became immensely frustrated by not being able to get the help they needed early on. I also spent some time working in alternative schools, as you know, and one of the frustrations there was that interventions did not happen early enough for these students to not need the services that they got later. And so I'm very happy to be involved with bringing forward, I think, a system that can really remedy and speak to a lot of those early intervention issues. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Bly, for bringing us this bill and for offering us an opportunity to explore a way to perhaps better serve our students. So at this point, we're going to the chair will lay over House File 2683. Members, we'll now have a discussion on the QCOMP teacher evaluation bills. My hope is that we can do that in about an hour, so hopefully we can get folks out of here in an hour, but I think that we had indicated we could, I think we said we could go to noon or so. I will not take us beyond noon. and so with that, what we're going to do is, what I'm going to do is have the department come forward just to provide us with some background information that just sort of, you know, reminds us, you know, about, you know, the QCOMP model, in particular the teacher evaluation work. Not a real in-depth, you know, but just enough to get us, you know, kind of warm up our mental engines, and then we'll dive into the bills before us and hopefully have a really good conversation. So with that, Mr. Corte.
Mr. Chair, members, Darren Corte from the Department of Education, thank you for giving us the opportunity to walk through kind of the QCOMP program. I have here with me Greg Keith and Debbie Lidke from the department. They're the experts on this, so I'm just going to turn it over to them right away to let them give you the overview.
Very well. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Greg Keith. I'm the director of the Division of School Support at the Minnesota Department of Ed. And I have Debbie Lepke here with me today. And we are prepared to speak regarding some context around what exactly is the QCOMP program to inform your discussion. The Quality Compensation for Teachers, or QCOMP program, was enacted in July 2005. It's a voluntary program that allows local districts and their teachers' unions to design and collectively bargain a plan that meets four components as defined by the program. Those four components include a career ladder or career advancement, teacher leadership options for teachers, job-embedded professional development, teacher evaluation of performance, and performance pay and an alternative salary schedule. We believe that effective teachers with strong instructional practices can improve student achievement, and that's at the foundation of the QCOMP program. as we work with districts and as districts implement the program. So the program is a professional development model that promotes the restructuring of school systems by utilizing teacher leaders and by providing teachers with time to meet in collaborative teams so that they can discuss instructional practices, student achievement data, and student work. The collaborative work of the teachers is to set goals for school-wide and individual student achievement, to improve instructional practices, and to work with teacher instructional leaders to improve classroom practices. The program includes a peer evaluation process for every teacher. That evaluation process is based on skills, responsibilities, and student academic improvement. Teachers are rewarded and paid based on performance, not just seniority. Currently, districts can fund their program with up to $260 per student. $169 of that goes to approved programs in state aid, and then $91 can be accessed through board-approved levy for the program. And each school determines how that funding and those resources will be utilized based on their individual plan. There's quite a bit of flexibility within the four components for districts to have some flexibility to design plans and utilize resources according to their needs and their priorities. Currently, we have 69 school districts and 66 charter schools that are implementing the QComp program in the current school year. And that covers 20% of all districts and 44% of all charter schools. About 45% of students in the state are enrolled in participating at a participating site. So it's a fairly expansive program. We have 9 district and charter school applications that have been approved for the upcoming school year. So 9 new programs, and then we have 15 pending applications, and Debbie's going to talk a little bit about the application and the monitoring process that districts engage in, and then the current work of the QComp districts to bring themselves into alignment with the teacher development and evaluation processes. I will add 2 things. We have currently, with the approved applications, we've reached the funding cap. And so $75.6 million. So we do currently have 2 unfunded approved applications. So those districts are making the decision whether they want us to hold on to their application, should funding become available, or if they want to retract their application. But we have currently reached the cap that's set. And then the last thing would just be one of our beliefs in working with districts. We believe that the program's success is due to the voluntary nature of the program, and that districts have flexibility to individualize their programs to meet their unique teacher and their unique student needs. And Debbie's going to talk a little bit about the actual application process and program requirements.
Mr. Chair and representatives on the committee, thank you for
Good morning, Ms.
letting us talk about QComp. Just a correction, we do have, it's 2 applications that we're now reviewing. 2 of those applications are not funded, so they're not approved yet, but there are not funds to move those to implementation. The application process is pretty simple, that the commissioner has set 3 deadlines that districts can submit, and district and charter schools can submit their applications. We have provided an application process and guideline booklet that can help guide districts to submit the information to the depth that needed so that we can move them to the approval status process to the commissioner. There is a revision process, a part of that, and that is extensive technical assistance we give those schools to clarify the language so that both parties can be understanding what they're agreeing upon moving forward about their application. The department also provides technical assistance and professional development to all our QCOM districts, not just in the revision process or in developing and writing their application, but actually in implementing. So many of our talented people back at the agency support districts in implementation, either through writing goals, knowing how to conduct effective observations, and providing feedback that really makes helps teachers rethink or improve or get better, refine their practice to meet the needs of the students in their classroom this year. We also provide extensively this year with our QCOM schools a lot of technical assistance and networking opportunities to align their QCOM programs with teacher development evaluation statute requirements. They do have many of the components in. They have actually farther along in that process of meeting the teacher development evaluation statute. But there are distinctly six or seven additional things they need to do to meet that statutory requirement that falls outside the purview of QCOM. So I have to emphasize that they are very collaborative in nature with each other and with the department, and informing us ways that they can meet the statutory requirements both around QCOM and teacher development evaluation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lucky. Are there any quick questions for department testifiers? All right. If not, thank you both. Actually, all three of you. Thank you very much. So at this point, what we're going to do is, so we have the four bills. I'm going to call them up. We'll actually do a formal motion to move, and then we'll be laying the bills over. And I think probably the best way to do this might be to just take very quick questions, you know, of each bill author and our witnesses. But then also make sure we are now allow enough time for once we're through with all four to be able just to have a kind of a more broader ranging conversation as we're comparing you know, the pros and cons of the different approaches before that. So with that, Representative Seltzer, why don't you come forward, and the chair will move that House File 2383. I'm sorry, 22, the chair moves that House File 2283 be referred to the Committee on Education and Finance. Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing this bill this morning. And as you already know and you've heard, right now we have two systems in place with a great deal of potential and considerable overlap. Our alternative teacher professional pay system, or QCOMP, which was just described to you, and our new teacher evaluation system, which, as you know, is being piloted and is set to be implemented next year. The MDE folks did a great job of outlining the fact that almost half of the students in the state of Minnesota right now are in a QCOM program. And what my bill does, as you know, is establishes a task force to look at bringing stakeholders to the table to better align the two systems. There is some of that work going on, but this would be more of a broad overview, and recommend a funding system that is fair and equitable for current QCOM and non-QCOM districts alike. So we have heard in the media and from various sources that QCOM does not work. And there is new evidence that we'll be looking at today that shows that it does work. And as Representative Sawatsky says, it takes years to actually implement a program and begin to show good results. And this program, as you know, has been in place, I think, for 8 or 9 years now, and is starting to reap some very good results. So we will be there. You should find a 3-page summary of the study that will be discussed today in your packet. And my point today is that QCOM does work, and that we should align this proven system that increases student achievement to our new teacher evaluation program to achieve maximum results. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have the study authors talk a little bit about their study, if that's all right.
Very well. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Representatives, for the chance to speak. I'm Aaron Sojourner. I'm a labor economist at the Carlson School of Management at the U. I do research on early childhood education, K-12 education, and also on labor unions. My colleagues and I did a study of the effect of QComp on student achievement. It's forthcoming in one of the top labor economics journals. There wasn't a lot of study. There's not been a lot of evidence on the impact of QComp. There was an early study done that just sort of compared QComp districts to non-QComp districts. We think, you know, the state spent hundreds of millions of dollars, the districts have, on this. It's been in place now for many years. There's a lot of evidence available, and so we thought it deserved a closer look with a sort of stronger research design that really can give us some confidence that we can measure the impacts. I'm not going to bore you with the details of the design. I'm happy to answer questions. I just want to say, you know, getting this right matters a great deal, and it's very hard to do well. Managing the teacher workforce in the state and structuring that relationship correctly in terms of designing the job, offering compensation, creating opportunities for peer collaboration, giving feedback and monitoring performance, measuring it well, is essential and will pay off very well down the road for our state in terms of a productive workforce, or not if we get it wrong. So your work is very important, and we're happy to have the chance to talk about it. And I'll turn it over to my co-author to tell you sort of the bottom line of what we found.
Thank you, Mr. Soldier. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Dr. Christine West. I'm at University of St. Catherine. I'm also a labor economist. I do a lot of work in program evaluation and public finance. I'm also a former public school teacher, and so all of my research is very passionate about making sure that we're doing well by our schools and our teachers. Like Aaron said, you know, we're not going to bore you with the details of the study design. We spent a very long time trying to make sure that we were doing the program justice and getting a result that we could believe in. We think that the study design emboldens us to make a causal statement about the impact of QComp. And we have found that the implementation of QComp causes a one-month growth in reading outcomes relative to what would have happened in these districts without QComp. We also looked at math. We don't find as strong of an effect in math, and we can talk about those details if you would like. I want to make a few points about this. One that's very important, we're economists, and so we want to talk about the cost effectiveness of the program. We find that 1 month of growth is approximately $1,000 if you were to pay for it in the traditional sense, like if you just were to extend the school year, $1,000 per student per year to extend the school year. By a month, and QComp costs on the order of magnitude you heard from the Department of Education only about $260 per student per year. So to us, that is a cheap way to get an extra month of learning, and it seems to us that's a return that's worth investing in. We did some other work about cost-benefit analysis, and it passes all of these on flying colors. A couple other key points. I know they mentioned that maybe you have an executive summary in your packets, but then I saw you shuffling, so I don't know if you do or not. Great. So there's one figure that we include from the paper in the executive summary because we think it's a very important figure to look at, and it shows that the impact of QComp seems to grow over time, that the longer districts are in the program, the more they're finding these results. So districts that have been in the program the longest seem to have the largest gains in reading relative to what they would have experienced in the absence of QComp. We also find another detail that I want to bring to your attention is that we find that the effect is stronger in schools that have less experienced teachers. So it's sort of an interesting something to chew on, to think about why is it that QComp is seeming to work most most well in places where they have teachers with only like 1 to 5 years of experience on their staff. It seems to be doing something for professional development there. We want to leave time for the other people to talk, but again, we're happy to be here to answer questions about the study and to answer questions about our understanding of QCOMP and how it's working and why it's working. One point I do want to leave you with is that QCOMP really is a bundle of reforms. You know, it's a lot of things that happened all at once, and we're not going to be able to really speak to what it is specifically within QCOMP that's working, but our study does find that there is something there that shouldn't be ignored.
Thank you, Dr. It's Dr. Lam West.
Yeah, Dr. West is fine. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. West. Please continue.
And hello, I am Dr. Karen Orcutt, and I am Superintendent of Schools in Orono. And I have with me Aaron Rulin, Mr. Aaron Rulin, who is our Director of Accountability and Learning. And we are here to advocate for QCOMP and to represent multiple districts that have had great successes in this program. So I want to highlight a couple of things that has literally been over time that we have learned and are continuing to learn the yield of this system in our district. And more than 7 years ago, we began to study. We had in place a long-term teacher evaluation system. We wanted to continually improve that system and took a look at QCOMP about 7 years ago. And we wanted something in place that would set high expectations and have a standard that we would be able to say, this is what we expect of an Orono teacher. And we wanted to develop common language around our expectations. But we really wanted at that time to focus on student growth as a measurable outcome of teacher evaluation. So we were after two things, the evidence of student growth, but also evidence of teacher growth and development over time. I can tell you that 6 years later, through QCOMP, we have established a system that did all and went beyond our expectations and beyond what I could have predicted for the program. We have increasing evidence in Orono of student growth. We have increasing evidence of teacher growth, and literally QCOMP has driven systemic change. When I look at the fine research that these folks have done, what is a little more difficult to research is the systemic change, but we have evidence of systemic change both within the organization and resultant student growth, and specifically student growth. We come out off of our best year ever of student growth and college readiness and ACT scores. I'm going to let Mr. Rulin tell you some of the specifics.
Members, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
Thank you. One of the people that wasn't with us today and is really symbolic of the kind of effort in our district is Mr. Paul Hamilton, who's our key teacher leader on the initiative. And one of the things that the additional capacity building activities that QCOMP has brought us are resources to bring teacher leaders along. So Mr. Hamilton has been critical in that. And we wouldn't be here today if it weren't for the collaborative relationships between management, teachers, the school board, and our community. QCOMP is woven into everything we do. Our entire teaching and learning process is supported by QCOMP resources, from teacher leadership to the goal-setting work that we do, to our mentoring program, to coaching for veteran teachers and for new teachers. So I'm not surprised that the impact is highest for our youngest teachers, because we provide a wraparound model where we have mentors, coaches, professional learning communities that they participate in, and it's really a model that is a human capacity development model that brings all people along, but particularly for our new teachers. Beyond those elements that are critical to teaching and learning in our school district, two things have happened through QCOMP. One is it forced us to come to the table around important incentives for how we do our work, management and teachers sitting down talking about how we're going to incent and compensate our teachers for the professionalism that we expect. And that was an incredible collaborative journey that really is serving benefits in all aspects of what we do. Secondly, we're talking about innovation and reform in professional pay. How long have we discussed a system of steps and lanes that may or may not provide the right incentives or process for our teachers to get better, that our communities trust, and that we as policymakers and leaders can be confident in? So QCOMP provides the resources to do that, and that's one of the ways that it really stands out in comparison to the other teacher evaluation statute. It's critical. So, Mr. Chair, you talked earlier about how quickly we can turn these things around and that sense of urgency versus the amount of time it takes. A massive amount of change that in a short period of time has made a big difference for us, and glad to see that the researchers are also showing that. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And can I just ask you to just formally state your name just for the record?
You bet. Yep. Thank you. Mr. Aaron Ruland. I'm Director of Learning and Accountability at the Orono Public Schools.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Ruland and Superintendent. And congratulations on the work that you've done, the movement that you've been able to make. Keep it up. Representative Erickson, you and I, you know, go back, you know, quite a ways on this on QCOMP, and I'm not abashed to say that you were out ahead of me on this issue. I caught up, I think. When Representative Grayling and I were chairing the two respective committees. We made it a point to make sure that we were continuing the investment in QCOMP. And the reports continue to come in, as we just heard from Orono and others, I will read this report, I think it continues to bolster my confidence of this incredible tool that we've been able to fashion legislatively, and that our practitioners have been able to really breathe life into. And many of the things that I've heard in the last few minutes are pretty consistent with some of the initial observations our legislative auditor made several years ago. So I'm convinced that we've got a really good, powerful tool here. And the question for us as we move forward in ergo to subject of the four bills before us, is how do we do that with the new framework of our teacher evaluation system and be very, very aware so that at the very least we're not doing harm to a good, effective tool that folks like the Orono people have been using. Any quick questions for these testifiers? Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you echoed some of my comments, so I thank you for being here today, and the research certainly is something we need to look at. I believe Dr. West pointed to one of the dilemmas we'll face here, because we're not simply looking at the existing QCOMP program, but we're looking at the rollout of a much broader and deeper teacher development and evaluation system that will cover all of our schools. And in your comments, Dr. West, you noted the fact that you couldn't really tease out what components it was that affect these results and the relationship between the professional development components and the performance pay components are certainly one of the things that will be on our on the table not only today but in our long-range considerations about how we support effective teacher evaluation. So just calling attention to that. I'm not asking you to solve a problem that you can't solve, but it is one of the things the state auditor called attention to, too, is that we can't tease out those differences. Actually, we might begin to see that as we move forward more fully with the full-blown teacher development and evaluation program.
Dr. Lamos.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, it's okay, Mr. Chair and Representative. My colleague Aaron and I were just talking about this before. What testimony could we give to the particulars of it? And there is research in other areas of other programs about individual components, about pay for performance absent professional development or evaluations absent a career ladder, just pulling apart the pieces. That was not the case for our research. And there is sort of economic theory we can draw on from other sectors to give sort of a broad sense of what we would expect to be the case. But you're correct to say that this particular research doesn't pull it apart.
Dr. Soldier.
So we just say that the evidence that we've seen here in Minnesota and from studying the evidence around the country is that, performance pay by itself doesn't seem to have big effects. We looked at sort of districts that paid low bonuses compared to districts that paid high bonuses to see if there were bigger effects, things like that. We couldn't see anything like that in our data. There is evidence from other places, Cincinnati, that you know, putting in a serious evaluation component with regular observations, that can have a positive effect just on its own without pay. So, I mean, so there's some evidence from around the country to be aware of.
Well, thank you. Any further questions? All right. Well, Representative Seltzer, we'll lay this over. Obviously, the bill and the task force being created will be on the table as we discuss going forward. I know you're not on the committee. You're certainly welcome to stay and answer questions if that comes up. But we will revisit your bill in short order. Thank you all for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So with that, the chair is going to lay House File 2283 on the table. Next, we'll hear from Representative Erickson, and this will be House File 2271. And Representative Erickson, I'm looking over here. Representative Erickson, would you care to move your bill?
Mr. Chair and committee, I'd like to move House File 2271 with the recommendation it be referred to K-12 Finance, but then honoring perhaps your decision, Mr. Chair, to lay it over.
Very well. This before us. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This proposal would streamline our QCOMP program, as we'll call it today, with the new teacher evaluation proposal that became law in 2011. I've actually worked on the alternative teacher performance pay since 2001. That's when we first started discussing it in this legislative body, informally and formally. And then in 2005, it was enacted and became law. And I think the testimony that we've just heard from Orno is really a solid proof that the program works, and it works over time, and it really is a great asset to our new teachers. So with that, as you take a look at House File 2271, you will notice that I have embedded QCOMP into the teacher evaluation law that we have in place. This is voluntary. This is also an excellent complement, the streamlining, for our world's best workforce. No longer would we need the improvement plans. They would be replaced by that strategic plan that districts are required to create in the world's best workforce legislation that we passed last year. Some of the highlights of the bill, and I'll just move this very quickly because I know we have lots before us. It links the compensation increase to the performance pay system, so those come together. It allows teacher contracts with the alternative pay system to be increments of either 4 years or 2 years, as they are now, and allows for current contracts to be reopened if, for the purpose of negotiations, the teachers and the school board want to do that. It renames the revenue stream, the compensation, to the evaluation and performance revenue. And the revenue is based on a similar formula, as you will notice as you look through the bill. The revenues will stay the same. It is on page 3, at 3.18, that you will notice that the QCOMP provisions are embedded. And, Mr. Chair, I do have a technical change. So wherever 2015 is stated, it should be 2016. Obviously, I'm not going to violate the budget resolution this year, so we'll look to the future for those changes when we get to the general education revenue that begins and the funding on page 7. With that said, I think that this would be a very good step for us to take as we implement a teacher evaluation this coming school year. And even listening to the RTI presentation, I know that my home district of Princeton, to which Mr. Wadle referred and uses RTI, would like to embed that as well. So they're thinking big picture. They want their QComp, which they've had since the get-go, and teacher evaluation, and then work in RTI at the same time. So I'm really proud that they're being so innovative in thinking about the future and how great teaching will be a boon to our student achievement, closing the gap, and also to learning by our students. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I think I've covered very quickly some of the highlights, because basically it is streamlining, and I think that's the move we should be making, at least from my perspective. It is also, as you can see, going to allow all school districts and charters to elect to join the program.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Erickson. And you do have several individuals, I believe, that want in the audience that wish to comment on the bill. So why don't we bring those individuals forward? And is there a particular order which you want me to
do? No, anyone who'd like to come and speak in behalf of or on behalf of the streamlining is welcome to come. If
very
no one
well.
Wants
Mr.
to come, then we'll
you,
stand
it's
for questions.
Ms. Faltzman, Ms. Wallstein, and I think there's maybe a superintendent, too, that also wishes to weigh in. Mr. Bartholomew, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name's Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and want to thank you for the opportunity this morning to share our perspective on the teacher evaluation and QComp laws. Just in the big picture, both of these laws are critical for helping teachers to gain a better understanding of their strengths and areas for improvement, to getting targeted professional development that's aligned with school and district goals, and for creating alternative compensation strategies based on meeting those goals. And I'll go from my testimony a bit, because it was great to see Dr. Sojourner and the other authors of the QComp evaluation. I was going to mention that as well, because we think it reinforces what you're trying to do today, and in particular Representative Erickson's bill, in the sense that, in short, the study found that QComp has improved student achievement, and that, as they mentioned, it has about a 5-to-1 benefit-to-cost ratio. And this is relevant because it's looking in the bigger picture at the impact of the combination of alternative compensation strategies and changes in human resource practices. The human resource changes include formal classroom observations with pre- and post-observation conferences, participation in professional learning communities, and targeted professional development. As has been mentioned, these are all common elements of both QComp and the teacher evaluation laws. And it was great to see again, as they mentioned, the relative permanence of the QComp program helped teachers and schools buy into making the changes. And the longer that a school participated, the greater the impact on student performance, especially in reading. So in the spirit of the unsession, and because there is duplication in the evaluation and professional development components of both QComp and the teacher evaluation law, we've supported Representative Erickson's bill, House File 2271, because we think it does an excellent job of consolidating and streamlining the two laws. For example, by transferring the alternative compensation part of QComp and placing it into the teacher evaluation law, we can drop the duplicative parts of QComp, and the state will have the best of both laws while also reducing duplication. Reducing duplication will strengthen the alignment between the teacher evaluation and compensation and district efforts towards creating the world's best workforce. And we also believe reserving funds for alternative compensation, as Representative Erickson's bill does, will provide a stronger incentive for districts to create meaningful options to existing salary schedules. Thank you very much for your efforts at streamlining two laws, which will improve student achievement and help meet the goals of the world's best workforce through teacher development and alternative compensation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Ms. Salzman.
I'm Kathy Saltzman from Students First, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I just want to thank you for having this discussion today. I think it's an important one. You're talking about two really important systems, the teacher evaluation system and also our quality compensation program in Minnesota. I think what's also important to note is that you, Mr. Chair, were very involved in the world's best workforce. And I think that there's a tie-in here, and I think that, you know, with this bill that representative has really worked on trying to streamline things. I think that's very important to be able to look at goals that districts are setting to close the achievement gap, to make sure that there are gains in, like, new proficiency, that we have a very specific plan. And so how do we tie that to the goals that are with our quality compensation program as well as our teacher evaluation system? We think that our state has piloted a more thorough and meaningful teacher evaluation system, and that's going to make the identification of great teachers much more consistent, and that we need to have a way to move away from our traditional steps and lanes to then, like, you know, reward these teachers, especially those that are young. We see that that right now, as school districts continue to pay teachers using pay schedules that really only recognize factors found to be not really great indicators of teacher quality, but based on years worked and degree levels, we really are not really recognizing the great younger teachers that are in our schools and making a really big difference. So we really applaud the efforts of this bill to streamline, to maintain the QCOM system, but also to make it available to all districts. And that's, I think, the piece that is very important here, is that we know a number of districts out there who really want to move forward, but really making this available to them is very, very important. So I just commend Representative Erickson for doing this, and all the bills that are out there that really recognize that QComp is very important. It was a very important step for Minnesota. We want to see that maintained and have a really good discussion on how we streamline that and really link it and align it with our teacher evaluation system. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Former Senator Salzman, we did some very good work together several years ago. Ms. Wallstein.
Hi, Amy Wallstein, Director of Education Workforce Development for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I wanted to just quickly testify in support of the merger, the conversations that the committee's having on merging QComp and teacher evaluation. Our organization is a strong supporter of QComp. We're a strong supporter of the teacher evaluation system. And I think Representative Erickson has put together a bill that has a lot of great elements in it. But I think that the other bills that are being considered by the committee also have some good pieces. So I just encourage the committee to continue to look at the four bills and to pull some of the best stuff from each of them into a package that merges the two systems into a streamlined teacher evaluation and professional development system. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wallstein. And I think we have someone who, a superintendent, who wished to... I just have superintendent on my note here, but perhaps not. Okay. Very well. Questions, comments from committee members? Representative Erickson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I do know that the financial part of the bill needs to be discussed in K-12, so I would hope that everyone would read and study that as we look at the other bills. I've tried to make it as straightforward as possible and to make sure we keep all the pieces in place and then make sure that we have the equalization available as well. So with that, I think I would just like to have you renew my motion to wherever you want to send it, Mr. Chair, and go on to listen to the other proposals.
Very well. So at this point, the Chair will make sure I get the right number. The Chair will lay 2775 on the table.
71.
Why am I? Well, I really am tired today. 2271 on the table. Thank you, Representative Hertz. Are we doing Brandon next? Or me? Yeah, next time, let's just have all the bills.
Chair Mariani, are you ready to move your bill?
Madam Chair, yes. I would move House Bill 2570 be referred to the Education Finance Committee.
And to lay over for possible inclusion?
That'll be the eventual motion.
All right. All right.
Or the eventual action.
Well, So Representative Mariani has moved that House File 2570 be referred to Education Finance, and you go ahead and present your bill.
So I'll do this very quickly, Madam Chair. This is a variation on a theme, so the idea here is to create a blend of our teacher evaluation system into the professional development component of the QCOP law. And we do that by creating an alternative revenue funding stream tied to that component of teacher professional development in QCOP. It would then make it eligible for districts that are in charters and intermediaries who are not currently participating in QCOP to access that alternative revenue funding stream if they adopt an education improvement plan as defined within the framework of our QCOP statutes. And that those be consistent with the teacher evaluation parameters in our teacher evaluation statutes. So all present QCOP systems would also, or all present QCOP participants would also have to align their professional development component with the teacher evaluation system as well. The revenue for those who are currently not in QCOP would be at the same level as those who are participating, so $169. In aid and 91 in levy. And we've got in the bill, it's a three-year funding time frame. The thinking of that had to do primarily with thinking about this as sort of a piloted approach so that we can learn things from this. And that's basically it. I do have from St. Paul Public Schools, Mary Doherty, to share thoughts and yes. To be brief.
Ms. Gilbert.
More lucid than yes. The chair is this morning.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools. And just to put a broad picture on this, currently 20% of the school districts in the state are participating in QCOMP. If you add all the charter schools, then 28% of all the districts and charter schools are actually under a QCOMP plan. And while that is a small amount, it represents, if you take all the students in the groups with QCOMP plans, it's about 45% of the state students and over 50% of all the teachers. So basically, I'm really pleased today that all these bills are addressing the problem that we have between the districts that have an approved QCOMP plan in place, because the state now has run out of an appropriation. So if any of these other districts or charter schools want to apply to QCOMP right now, the department will continue to approve the plan, but there's no money to actually fund them unless another district drops out. So we've kind of hit the point where there's kind of a future equity issue with districts that want to participate in some kind of a program that would provide opportunities to do professional development and teacher evaluation. So we are supporting all the efforts from all the members, again, to try and allow these other districts that hadn't approved the QCOM plan the opportunity to address the teacher evaluation. In St. Paul, we have over 3,400 licensed teachers that we're going to be having to do an evaluation on. We have, of that group, 23, almost 2,400 of them are regular ed teachers. We have close to 900 special education teachers and close to 200 ELL teachers. And within the regular ed ranks, that ranges anywhere from art, dance, and music to Japanese, German, French. So it is a wide, you know, OT, PT nurses that we are going to have to develop a system for and a rubric to ensure that we are doing a good, high-quality job with the teacher evaluation system and provide the peer coaching that will be part of a plan that we will be negotiating to do the implementation. And so, as you can imagine, with the scope of size of all these districts, it's going to require some resources, and we just support efforts that would provide the additional revenue to put the trained evaluators in place, to train the evaluators, the peer coaching in place, that'll be necessary to do the implementation. The one difference between Representative the Chair's bill and Representative Reinhart's bill is your bill provides the aid the first year, and I don't know where the levy component is. I know for fiscal 25 it's too late to levy for it anyway because districts have already done that, but we would hope as whatever bill moves forward to provide this option that it would include both the aid and levy portion that would make it comparable to QCOM.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Any other comments from the author? Otherwise, I'll invite public testimony.
Yeah, that'd be fine, then.
Is there anyone who would like to testify on Representative Mariani's bill? I didn't ask for questions from members. Are there any comments or questions from members at this point? All right.
Madam Chair, I would move that. Actually, I would ask the chair to move that House File 2570 be laid on the table.
So I will move that House File 2570 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. And we'll play musical chairs.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Reinder moves House File 2775 be referred to the Committee on K-12 Education, Finance Education.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we have variation on the theme today, and I think we all understand that we have some common goals here in understanding the importance of the journey that we're on. The context for this bill has already been drawn in a number of ways. Full implementation of teacher evaluation will move forward in the fall of 2014. So many have worked so very hard to develop both state and local evaluation models, and the pilot projects are at midpoint. There is a sense of urgency here. How do we support this amazing work as it gets off the ground? Now, I'm going to just mention that I'm working from the DE1 amendment in the conversation, if you have that. It wasn't clear, so I'm not going to go in the details yet, but I saw maybe some puzzled looks about that, so sorry for interrupting.
Do members have the DE1 amendment?
The DE1 amendment ought to be with the bill itself. Okay. So what is our responsibility beyond the policy to the full implementation of the practice? How do we reconcile the robust language of our teacher evaluation statute with the more skeletal evaluation section of the Alternative Teacher Performance Pay System, alias QCOM? More critically, how do we reconcile the distance between the district that is only at the early edge of a full-blown evaluation system and the district that has a long history with a road-tested model of evaluation and development? House File 2775 is an effort to respond to these questions. In plain language, this bill moves to align the Teacher Development and Evaluation System under 122A40 and 122A41, with teacher evaluation as it occurs in 122A414, Alternative Teacher Professional Pay System. It is a minimalist approach, recognizing the breadth and depth of the evaluation effort itself. And I'm just going to call attention to what I have in my hand here. These booklets are the Teacher Development, Evaluation, and Peer Support Model for the program that will go into effect this fall, and Student Learning Goals. So these materials will be hitting the ground, new for hundreds of our districts. Only, well, our QCOMP districts and our pilots may have some elements of these in place, but really we're starting fresh on a very broad journey for our school districts. I started to say it's a minimalist approach, recognizing the breadth and depth of the evaluation effort itself as it moves forward through Minnesota schools this fall. It seeks to bring equity among our schools as these robust processes are engaged. It seeks to respect the journey that we have undertaken as a state and support these systems with time and resources so that they can be tested, modified, and refined to do the work of engaging, developing, and supporting our entire teaching staff toward effective and exemplary performance. And of course, a key element in the discussion that we've already noted is teacher development and evaluation is a mandatory program throughout all of our schools. Our alternative teacher performance pay system is a voluntary program. How we understand how those two will overlap and move forward is critical to what we do in the next 5 years, I think, to bring alignment to those. We have with us today testifiers who each offer a distinct professional perspective on this approach. We'll begin with Jane Gillis from Education Minnesota.
Good morning, Ms. Gillis.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to defer right away to my colleague from Pine Island, Cindy Hansen, and we're asking her to go first because she needs to get on the road and get back to her district. Cindy.
Good. Good morning, Ms. Hansen.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. I am here today as a principal of a K-8 school in Pine Island, Minnesota. I have 850 students. I evaluate 59 teachers. 17 of those are probationary or non-tenured, and we're part of the pilot, but we are not a QCOMP school. So I'm just here to talk to you about the pilot and some successes that we have had and some challenges that we have seen through that process. So first, some very good things about the pilot that sound very similar to what I've heard about QCOMP things today. My teachers are appreciative of the feedback they're receiving through the pilot. It's pretty intense from an evaluator's perspective, but the teachers like it. They like having conversations with me, with each other, about teaching and good instructional practices. They want to do a good job in their classroom, and they welcome my presence or their colleagues' presence in their classrooms to do that work. So that they have an option of peer review, which they have not had before in their teacher evaluation model. That has been well received. Our PLCs have become more robust because of the teacher evaluation model. We have a stronger focus on data because they had to set student learning goals. In fact, we have data coaches that we added this year at Pine Island to help us in that process. They had to write an individual growth plan to grow as professionals, and they have some measure of choice through things called points of contact. It's not just formal observations where I'm going in. They get to choose some of the feedback that I give them, and that can be a variety of things, a video lesson. It can be just a conversation with me about curriculum. It can be a conversation with me about student data, student surveys, those kinds of things. So all of those measures of choice, they really appreciate. And I, as an evaluator, appreciate them. The challenges that we have had and that we will have once our funding through the pilot runs out are probably similar themes that you've heard most of the morning, and that is time and resources. As part of the pilot, we've gotten access to some funds that have allowed us to provide release time to teachers to perform some of the activities related to the pilot, especially the peer review pieces. And when we don't have that support, that will be very challenging for them to do in a meaningful way, to give them extended blocks of time to have thoughtful conversations about their practice. And also from an evaluator's perspective, not all districts are like mine, but I have a very large staff, and there are districts like that in the state or where the evaluator wears multiple hats as superintendent or principal, and the amount of time that it takes to do this job and do it well, and we want to, is pretty significant. Last week, I had 24 face-to-face meetings with teachers. Each of those are about a half an hour long, and many of those require about a half an hour of preparation before that. So about 50% of my time last week was spent on teacher evaluation as part of the pilot. That's a lot. And if we're going to continue that work, that's not sustainable in my district. We can't keep that up. So certainly we would support anything that would give us access to some resources to be able to continue that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hanson. Are there any questions for Ms. Hanson? If not, safe travels back.
Thank you.
Ms. Gillis.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jane Gillis, and I work as an education issues specialist at Education Minnesota. Much of my work is devoted to helping educators prepare to implement the Teacher Development and Evaluation, TDE, requirements that were passed in 2011. With colleagues from Education Minnesota and the Minnesota School Boards Association, I have traveled all over the state helping teams of teachers and school administrators understand statutory requirements and design plans that integrate the new policy with existing district initiatives. I can tell you that educators are rolling up their sleeves and working incredibly hard to design local TDE plans. I can also tell you that folks are struggling to determine how to implement this complex policy well with existing resources. And I can tell you that QCOMP districts are far ahead of most other districts because, as you know, many of the TDE requirements are already part of existing QCOMP plans. My colleague Andrea Ciccone and I will be walking you through an overview of House File 2775 and the Delete All Amendment, which aligns TDE with QCOMP. You should have a handout in your materials titled Aligning Teacher Evaluation Programs. And on that handout, you will see that the left-hand column lists the bill's components, while the right-hand column indicates where the components can be found in existing statute. The bill establishes two tiers of evaluation components. Tier 1 consists of TDE requirements for all districts and charter schools, while Tier 2 consists of additional requirements for those schools that wish to opt for QCOMP. Tier 1 maintains all the major TDE requirements passed in 2011. So still in place are the requirements for a 3-year review cycle, individual growth and development plans, summative evaluations, peer review, the portfolio option, a teacher improvement process, measures of student growth to account for 35% of a teacher's evaluation, and student engagement data. The Tier 1 requirements I just outlined are critical to successful evaluation systems, and they remain at the core of the bill under consideration. I can tell you that my experiences traveling around the state have taught me that educators take these requirements very seriously and see their promise for improving teaching and learning in Minnesota. But I also must say that Minnesota educators are concerned that the promise of this policy will not be fulfilled without proper funding. Andrea.
Well, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. My name is Andrea Ciccone, and I'm a negotiation specialist with Education Minnesota. And part of my responsibilities are to work directly with our locals who have implemented or are working to implement a QCOMP plan. What I'd like to do is just very quickly review the areas of alignment in House File 2775. And you'll see those on the proposal summary on the back side of that handout. These alignments are fairly specific because they're rooted in our practical experience in the field with our locals in areas where the evaluation statutes 122A40 and 41, where those specific requirements line up with what's happening in QCOMP districts, and where we recognize that they would benefit from some explicit alignment within the statutes. So one of the issues that we've brought forward through this bill is in an effort to recognize the cost that's associated with professional learning communities, we've added some flexibility. All districts already have the requirement to coordinate their professional development with their evaluation process and their outcomes. What this specifies is that districts may use the particular PLC model, but refers really to job-embedded professional development opportunities. And looking at what existing QCOMP or ATPPS districts are already doing, it makes specific the mandate that's already been in place based on department guidelines for PLCs for QCOMP districts. So that was one alignment that we worked to provide here. This bill preserves the elements of a performance pay plan and maintains career ladders for teacher development, leadership development. The evidence that you've heard from previous testifiers, from the superintendents to Dr. Sojourner and Dr. West, looked at the totality of all of these elements together, so it was very important to preserve those elements within this bill. And noting again, specifically on the performance compensation requirements, working to bring those in alignment. We're working to preserve the good work that QCOMP districts have already done. You've heard some of the benefit of that program. And so we do in this bill preserve the pay associated with site-based goals, which look at student growth based on performance measures. And then the second required pay component is associated with student achievement. And what we've tried to do here is align that requirement with the student growth measures in the evaluation statute, which may include value-added models or student learning goals. We've seen in the locals that are already working on this that that's indeed what's happening. And finally, the last element of performance pay that's required under the QCOMP statute has to do with pay associated with evaluation. And I want to note this as just one of the trickier elements to align. The larger evaluation statutes look at evaluation on a 3-year cycle, and that means there's a summative outcome after 3 years working together. Performance pay is earned annually, and in order to make sure that the elements specific to evaluation for QCOMP have that annual component preserved, what we've tried to do is align the specific evaluation rules that are under the second clause in 122A40 and 41. We've tried to align that with the evaluation requirements in ATPPS, which has the effect of preserving the plans that are already in place for our, in this case, almost 80 districts that either have a plan or are working to implement one. And I will just mention that the requirement that the salary schedule is reformed is maintained and in place. That happens differently, however it's negotiated at the local level. And I would be foolish not to mention the fact that we are preserving a funding structure for QCOMP, similar to Representative Erickson's bill. What we've tried to do is create a parallel structure for teacher development and evaluation in which everybody would qualify for $169. And speaking to the specific needs of our intermediate and other cooperative districts, we've looked at an average number for based on a per teacher basis to provide funding for those folks at their request. So with that.
Thank you, Ms.
Ciccone.
Ciccone.
Thank you.
Sometimes it's Ciccone, and in this case it's Ciccone.
In this case, Mr. Chair, it is Ciccone. I tease Mary Ciccone that I say it the right way.
I suspect there's some back and forth there.
Mr. Chair, we have some brief testimony from two other sort of on-the-ground educators in this area.
Terrific. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. I am Diane Georgie. I'm a curriculum coordinator in Forest Lake Area Schools, 30 years of classroom experience. Our district has not yet implemented QCOMP, but I was approached last fall about chairing a committee to develop a plan for QCOMP, knowing that the teacher evaluation plan was on the horizon. And there was concern in our district because, as is often the case, the budget is tight. And to be able to implement that plan, we felt would take some significant funding. So we pursued QCOMP funding. We had a committee of administrators and teachers who worked very collaboratively. We spent hundreds and hundreds of hours spending time actually researching other districts and what they've done with QCOMP, found what we thought were the best components of many of them, and really have generated great support among the teachers, administrators, and our community about what our QCOMP plan is. We received approval from MDE over the summer, so did not get to bring it back to our teachers until this fall. So we actually asked for a deferment, and we'll be implementing in fall of 2014. Knowing that teacher evaluation is coming into play at the same time, I am now on a committee that is looking at the teacher evaluation plan. We did keep that in mind as we developed our QCOMP plan and aligned the required pieces of QCOMP to what teacher evaluation had in place, and are now working at the additional pieces to see if we can find a way to dovetail those together. It would be helpful to have the two programs aligned. We also know that we are very fortunate to have that money in place for us for next year with QCOMP, and we are not sure what we would do without that funding, because the plan we have developed, we feel, is high quality. It really emphasizes professional development and support for teachers and teacher growth, working towards student achievement, and we feel that the funding is going to be key in continuing that progress as we get started with that.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Amy Vollendorf. I've worked in the Wayzata School District for the past 10 years. I'm a licensed special education teacher and administrator, and I'm currently serving in the role of a program support specialist. For the past 6 months, I've been a member of the Wayzata Teacher Development and Evaluation Committee. We just finished designing our plan, and we are starting our recite presentations. During the beginning of our work as a committee last fall, as we analyzed the requirements of the new evaluation system, we realized that as a QCOMP district, we were already using some of the components of the teacher development and evaluation process. We started with reviewing and providing recommendations, if appropriate, to these components: professional learning communities, job-embedded professional development, mentoring and induction, and peer review. We focused on improving our individual growth and development plans, measures of student growth. And then we developed the summative evaluation, student engagement and connection protocols, and the teacher improvement process. Because we had six major components already developed, we devoted a majority of our time to researching and developing a new model for our summative evaluations that will be done by our principals. We are excited about this model because and believe it will enable our supervisors and teachers to have a meaningful, ongoing conversation about professional practice and student achievement. A majority of our committee time was spent reflecting on the current model of supervision and evaluating, brainstorming possibilities, and developing this new practice. Secondly, we researched and developed a peer assistance component into our teacher improvement plan. After researching this method of support and visiting with another school district that has been used this model for a long time, we determined it would be an appropriate tool for teachers as we collectively support them in the improvement process. As I stated earlier, the committee members have started presenting to our TDE plan to our schools. Teachers have expressed relief, as did our committee members, that we have had many of the components embedded into our QCOMP program. There's been quite a bit of fear about this evaluation system over the past year, and this reassurance alleviated some of the fear with our committee members, and we expect that it will have a similar impact with our staff. As a committee, we are hopeful that because of our staff is comfortable with many of the components, the time they spend learning and implementing a new system will be less stressful. But most importantly, we believe that we'll be able to focus on efforts to streamline and embed the summative process into their daily work in a meaningful manner, which we know will have a positive impact on the students. I support this bill's effort to align QCOMP with the teacher development and evaluation process. Our teacher development and evaluation committee appreciated the alignment, and that was already part of our work, and I know that it would be the same for many other districts.
Well, thank you. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Briner, why are you not linking teacher performance and student achievement or student proficiency?
Representative Briner.
Instead, you're going to growth. Why are you not linking those?
Representative Erickson, I'm not sure I understand your question. What are you referring to specifically in our proposal?
Well, because thank you, Mr. Chair. When we submitted our teacher evaluation to the Department of Education as part of our waiver, it contained 35% student achievement. Mm-hmm. But now I think your bill is going to growth and leaving achievement or proficiency as secondary. So I want to know why you're doing that.
Mr. Chair, no, we did not change that language in the teacher development and evaluation portion of the bill at all. That full, the connection between the 35% and assessment tools are still remain in the TDE portion. What we didn't do is carry over that 35% language into the QCOMP language, precisely because those are the components attached to performance pay, and that's a different issue for districts to determine. So we did not want to bias existing agreements in any manner. All districts are committed to the TDE portion of statute regardless. So they're all addressing that 35% in terms of their evaluation tools.
Mr. Chair?
Sir.
Well, Representative Brainerd, I'm looking at line 6.19. I think this is in the delete all. Yes, it is in the delete all. And it specifically says under number 2, measures of student growth that may include value-added models. It doesn't, achievement is deleted. So that's what I'm concerned about.
Representative Brainerd.
Thank you.
And I know that's in the QCOMP section, but still.
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson. That is in the QCOMP section, but it also, if you go to 2.13, 2.14 of the DE1 amendment, you'll see Clause 9 of the TDE statute. We simply took that language out of that statute, measures of student growth that may include value-added models or student learning goals, and we didn't go to the 35%. The assessment, the valid and reliable assessment data portion of that could be considered to be referenced in the school-wide student achievement gains under Roman numeral 1. But regardless, in terms of the teacher evaluation tool, the full measure, every district is under that clause, all aspects of it. What we were trying to do is not obligate districts in terms of the performance compensation components of their agreement to language that came after their agreements were in place.
Mr. Chair? Another question, Representative Brainerd. How do you plan to make your proposal align with the world's best workforce strategic plans? As I alluded to in my presentation, getting rid of the improvement plans now is, from my perspective, a good thing to do because districts are creating a strategic plan that should be, the improvement plan. So how do you plan to work that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, from my perspective, it may be premature to create that alignment. And this is why I say, why I referred to the text of the Teacher Development Model and Student Learning Goals Handbook is the work on the table of districts who have not participated in the QCOMP process is overwhelming from some perspectives in terms of they're starting from ground zero. So they really, this evaluation model needs an opportunity to come up to speed. Districts need a chance to grapple with the evaluation model in its own terms. And then I think there can be incremental alignment sought between these systems in terms. So I say right now we're seeking statutory alignment but not overlapping the systems, except where they obviously are already overlapped by districts that are choosing to participate in QCOMP, but that leaves that choice component versus the mandatory component of the teacher evaluation model and allows the TDE model to move forward on its own terms, which I think are in themselves pretty demanding terms.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a comment. I was just looking in my proposal to truly streamline so that districts who I know are really very busy right now developing those strategic plans that are called for in the World's Best Workforce, so that even if you don't have the Alternative Teacher Compensation Plan or QCOMP, that you still could focus on having one major goal instead of having to have these extra pieces. So that's just a comment, and maybe we can work on that as we move along.
Very well. Let's talk about it.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson. Well, I'd be happy to have that discussion with you and Chair Marquardt, too, in relation to his language around the world's best workforce.
Very well. Members, any other questions or thoughts? We're knocking on the noon hour here. Representative Blythe.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. As a number of years ago, when I was teaching in Northfield, I co-chaired the committee to look at QCOMP as a possibility for our district. Teachers in Northfield elected not to pursue QCOMP, but the district went ahead with a lot of the teacher evaluation and growth and other principles that are in there. And I think there's much that's powerful in all of that that can help us improve. And as was reported, many of the teachers there talked about the excitement they had about meeting and talking with other teachers. And they also liked the notion of the career ladder and things like that, where you could, as a teacher, move into other things. However, the discussion that we had as teachers and also research that I had done has given me concerns, although I know pay for performance is popular in a lot of different areas. There are cautions to be had about it, and I think there's a tremendous amount of literature and discussion about what some of the problems with linking too closely the tests and the evaluations of what's happening with students and pay, individual pay. I think we've seen in other states, too, that these linking them too closely can have corrosive effect. It can be a result in cheating or falsifying some reports, and we need to be really careful about that. But I also think I don't like the idea of linking teacher improvement too strongly with pay, because I think teachers, in my experience, want to improve their skills and their teaching and be evaluated by other teachers in a way that is not connected to whether or not they're going to get more pay, but really professionally improving their standing as teachers and their ability to teach. And so it always causes me some concern to hear this overemphasis on making sure that teachers are paid for the way that their students perform, when there are so many variables involved in what happens with a student in a school year and the tests that they take, much beyond the control of a teacher or the ability of a teacher to have some impact. So I just put those out there as some comments that that I'm wary of as we talk about these, linking these two ideas. There are many good things about QCOMP. I don't mean to say that we shouldn't continue with that, but a word of caution.
Very well. Members, we are at that noon hour. I'm violating, as usual, my own set of expectations. So we've got a pretty rich landscape here from which to make some decisions in the coming weeks. A further stakeholder group on how to align QCOMP and our teacher evaluation system, and part of that comes with a message of be very diligent about anything that you do relative to this instrument, and think about whether we should be moving more aggressively or less so relative to QCOMP. An approach to transform our QCOMP system by way of extending teacher evaluation resources and tying that to a stronger performance-based system. A blending of teacher evaluation with a new revenue stream into QCOMP that would bring in non-QCOMP participants for the new revenue through a limited, if you will, QCOMP door, and then a separate funding stream for non-QCOMPs participating entities that, and keeping a separate funding stream for teacher evaluation for those already in QCOMP. big questions about whether and how much and how to reform QCOMP. And of course, the nut that we're all trying to crack, which is how to provide. And I have to say, I think, you know, where we all meet is this strong desire to provide a new stream of revenue along QCOMP, different ideas of QCOMP filters, if you will, for all districts. And of course, you know, then the details are always, you know, where the devil lies, right? But we have some very clear options, I think, before us, and I think we should engage in them very openly and struggle and push with one another in terms of coming out with something that can get some much-needed resources out to school districts all around the state as we move aggressively forward with our statewide teacher evaluation system. So what we'll be doing in the next week or two is we'll be bringing these bills back off the table, and you know, I suspect some of the language will change in them. I know you have a DE1 amendment we were not able to move today. Others may also, and we'll construct the best response that we can agree to inside of 2 weeks. With that, the chair is going to lay House File 2775 on the table. And lay over House File 2775. Man, I need to go home and get some sleep. With that, members, have a great weekend, and we'll see you all next week. We stand adjourned.